Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Jessica Hochman, pediatrician and mom of three. On this podcast, I like to talk about various pediatric health topics, sharing my knowledge not only as a doctor, but also as a parent. Ultimately, my hope is that when it comes to your children's health, you feel more confident, worry less, and enjoy your parenting experience as much as possible. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Ask Dr. Jessica podcast. I'm so happy to have you here, and thank you so much for listening. Today is part two of the podcast with Dr. Mike Rucker, and we talk about his book, The Fun Habit. We're going to pick up our conversation talking about having quality time with loved ones at the expense of making more money. In this episode, we also talk about experiences, relationships, material possessions, and happiness in general. I really enjoyed learning from Dr. Rucker, and I encourage everyone to read his book, The Fun Habit. The messages in his book are truly life-changing. I like how you talk about how it's important to think about the scarcity of time rather than focus on money and salary. I think that's such an important concept.
Yeah. So in psychology, we call that time affluence, but there's a whole host of different studies to suggest that the folks that do, you know, have a prevalence to looking at affluence more of agency and autonomy over time rather than, you know, collecting money, are the ones that tend to be better off because we just make better choices under that, right? I think the example that you highlighted is perfect. And that is, you know, okay, we have 365 days in the year. Yeah, this hour is not going to be the funnest thing, you know, because it is kind of homework, but the dividends that it will pay because now we know what we're doing becomes important because for what we know is the folks that don't do that, right? Kind of mortgage, you know, enjoyment right now for some future state, you know, whether that's because, you know, meritocracy is, you know, completely ingrained in them or, you know, this kind of idea that time equates money, you know, is so prevalent that, you know, the idea of taking 1 hour off, you know, they metaphorically see money fly out of their pockets. Ultimately, these folks aren't going to have energy down the line. And so, yes, valuing time at least as equally as money and thinking about it as a construct that you need to use wisely has, you know, all the benefits that we talked about, you know, throughout the podcast.
The more and more I think about what I want to get out of life and parenting and work and is really quality time, quality experiences, and less about what money can physically buy. I look at my kids and I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but I think the things I will buy them will make them happy. Like we'll go out for dessert or I'll buy them a present. And inevitably they end up fighting or there's some sort of argument after those activities because they'll compare their gift to their sibling's gift and they'll feel slighted in some way. My sister got more ice cream. That's not fair. He got the cone. That's not fair. And and you talked about this in your book, this idea of comparison really making us feel less happy and bringing less joy. And so I find with my kids that the things that I physically buy them makes them seemingly less happy, where when we do experiences together and we do things as a family, that's really where I find more joy and more fun as our family unit.
Yeah, that, you know, is clear. I think, you know, those have their place, but it's clear that experiential, you know, things tend to have more longitudinal value because the luster of any material good is eventually going to go away, right? We know that. But like if, you know, it's a guitar or it's sports equipment, like I, you know, I don't villainize that. You know, other people have, you know, talked about how those things, you know, can have more utility than we give them credit. And I do agree with that. I think where I'm trying to go is adding one other piece that I found fascinating, if you remember in the book, is, but if you do get the child like a whole plethora of toys, then they're kind of stuck trying to figure out like what to do with each one of them. And so paradoxically, and again, I just find it fascinating, right? The kids that are having the most fun are obviously the ones that have some toys, right? Like if, you know, again, kind of looking at something like Maslow's triangle, if you see all of these kids having something and you don't have anything, I don't want to skirt the fact that that's probably not the funnest place, but when they look at kids that kind of just have a modest amount of things versus, you know, all of the things, the ones that have the modest amount of things find amazing ways how to use them, you know, use each one in the funnest ways, tend to be the most creative, you know, have these elaborate stories, you know, especially younger children, you know, because they find like really creative ways to use their toys instead of just sitting and figuring out like, okay, how does this next little trinket work? You know, kind of what adults do, right? Like, they're waiting for instructions instead of just immersing themselves in the pure joy of like creativity and having fun with this thing that's like, you know, interesting.
Yeah, almost like quality over quantity. If you're careful about what you pick to purchase, I feel like you can really maximize joy from those items.
Absolutely. And you're more deliberate, right? Like, there is more premeditation. And is this, you know, the thing that is going to bring me lasting joy versus like, you know, the crying child and you just essentially want to, you know, escape that discomfort of the moment, like, you know, in the hopes that it will bring joy. But to your point, you know, generally it doesn't.
And I like what you talk about, how having fun doesn't have to be expensive. I think that a lot of sure money's helpful and it can help plan more trips, more elaborate vacations, but you can have plenty of fun in ways that aren't too costly.
Yeah. And I think why that's especially important is that when you find kind of lower hanging fruit, right, it tends to happen more prevalently, you know? And so, you know, what are the things that you can do at home? How can you rearrange the environment so that it is more fun? You know, what can you bundle that's already there? How can you have conversations with your loved ones so that you're co-creating these experiences so that, again, what you found kind of arduous, you know, before because you didn't really have input, now is something that is enjoyable because you're like, okay, I'm attacking it in a way where this activity is fun. And so like a common example, right, is how many parents you see at the park who are just kind of killing time, you know, scrolling social media because they feel like they just need to get their kid out of the house. When if they reminded like maybe a sport they like to play, or if they're into theater, you know, many communities have public theater that are available, whatever is your jam, like asking your child, would you like to do this with me, and actually engaging in them. Now, not only are you creating that core memory, right, because you're not just, it's not just another day at the park, you know, it's like, oh, we did this amazing thing that day. But you're also, you now have a relationship with the child. And the added benefit of that is that if you get yourself in a childlike state, oftentimes the rapport that develops there, you'll get a lot more disclosure from them than you ever would in that parent-child relationship where they're like, you know, they feel there's some things that they have to hold back because that's just the natural sort of, you know, communication agreement of a parent and a child, right? Where, again, if they see you in these moments as kind of a peer, what a lot of parents report is like, oh my gosh, I'm learning things about them that they, you know, would have never disclosed before, you know, in the context of how's your day or how did school go? You know what I mean?
It's true. No, I think it's easy to be sort of lazy at the park. A lot of us parents are tired between work and kids. And so it's just easier in some ways just to sit on the bench and scroll through our phones. But you're right. If you sort of force yourself to get up and play with your kids and be silly and playful, it's such a more meaningful experience. It really helps deepen your relationship with your child. And they remember it. They remember when you're the parent that gets up and plays with them. So I think Absolutely. For so many reasons, it's so important just to remind yourself, force yourself just to get up and play with your kids.
Yeah. And look back, and I mean, most of us as adults can already perceive that time is moving fast. So even just that, again, sort of, okay, you know, even if it seems a little bit like work at first, most people will find after 2 or 3 weeks that not only does it not feel like work, but they actually have more energy. You know, so this notion that like, I'm so depleted, I just couldn't integrate this into my day. Like, once you figure out that stride, and it might take a couple hits and misses, like your child thinks they want to play soccer because that's what you loved in college. And you find out actually once they tried it, they hate it. And so don't completely abandon it. You know, they're good, you know, give it a couple weeks to figure out like, what is it that's really going to light both of you up? But I'm telling you, those folks that feel like, I just, you know, my life is so hard, I can't find the energy for that. If they do, and again, take baby steps, right? Let's just play with 1 or 2 hours, you know, and then start building on that. They'll find that when they check in with themselves, they're actually invigorated. So, you know, coming out of that, they're in a much better place than they would have been if, again, they just displaced, you know, that time with, you know, social media use or, you know, kind of just being bored and letting that hour pass by.
And explain a little bit the science behind the oxytocin and why getting together and working on spending time on relationships really matters. I think that's fascinating when you describe that in the book.
Yeah, that was an insight. Again, Paul Zak's doing some amazing work, you know, in this area. But all of these neurochemicals that we commonly talk about, and I confess it in the book, right? We use so simply, right? We talk about dopamine being associated with pleasure, but we really now know that it's more excitability and anticipation, right? And that's why we love it, because it's, you know, the variable reward and it has these evolutionary purposes. Another interesting thing regarding what we've learned about neurochemicals is that to be able to get oxytocin, which is really what makes us feel connected, right? So if we're kind of feeling disassociated and burnt out and, you know, like the problems are bigger than they should be, oxytocin is really helpful in that regard. But we can only really receive it through prosocial behavior. It's essentially that interaction with others. So you could think about it as you're able to give it, but you need other people to receive it. And so under that context, it does become important to figure out how can you strengthen the bonds of these relationships, you know, with things that are fun, because when you're enjoying the time that you spend with others, you're drawn to those activities, right? And when, again, you're in that place of like, I have to do this, right? Then that empathy goes down and there's no connection. And so likely, are you not even excited about doing it? So, you know, you're not benefiting from, you know, any neurochemical for that matter. You're certainly not making a connection. And when it gets really bad, right? And I'm sure you've seen this, you can actually start to see fissures, which is so unfortunate, right? When the child picks up on the fact that you feel like it's work and you really don't want to do it, then all of a sudden, you know, it can get into this realm where you're asking, why are we doing it in the first place? And that is a really dark spot. So to the extent that you can use some of these simple tools to change that circumstance, does become important, especially trying to get in front of it before, you know, it becomes too late.
Yeah. And quite frankly, I feel like as parents, we owe it to our kids to figure out how to make them feel important, make them feel like there's nothing else more important in our lives, and how to give them our undivided attention and not make them feel like they're like that there's something else more important in our lives when we're with them.
Yeah. And I'll hammer it home one last time, but I think if you feel the burden of that, like, okay, I'm in this place where I realize I'm not doing that and I desperately want to fix it, just show some grace and practice, right? It's not going to come all at one time. So we're not suggesting like, okay, starting tomorrow, you always have to be mindful, because especially if you're depleted and burnt out, right? Like, it's not sustainable. And I would put that under the umbrella of toxic positivity, right? But do start experimenting with it. See what it's like when you put your phone away and spend 30 minutes, you know, if you've never done it before, just actively listening instead of trying to, you know, control or parent, and see the benefit, you know, of what happens. And it will always be, you know, as a generality, restorative and something you want to do more. But then it doesn't become overwhelming, right? This imperative, like, I've got to completely change my parenting style.
And honestly, I mean, I'm as a pediatrician, I'm around kids all day, and I find them to be such a good influence on me. They're so much more fun than us adults. They're not as serious. They're so light and easygoing. And honestly, I think for all of us, we have to remember that they are good for us. Like, we are good for them, but I think even more I get back from being around children.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the concept there is social contagion, right? And to the extent that you can lower your guard and start to take cues from them, there's a whole host of benefits there that, you know, we could have a whole nother podcast about. But, you know, they teach you again to think in a nonlinear fashion. They will introduce you to awe and wonder in ways that you have long forgotten, right? Like, where they're just explaining the moon to you and you're like, what? Like, you know, yeah. It will recapture your imagination of what it means to make meaning again. Right? And so I wholeheartedly agree. Once you get into that mode and allow them in, and you're in a, you know, place of safety to do that, absolutely. And it's just, it really is fun, you know?
And I'm just curious, with all your research and reading on this topic, has it influenced you as a parent? I'm sure it has to have, but can you describe how it's influenced you?
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly the time aspect is one that we've talked about, you know, looking at that and how I want to create those memories using that idea of scarcity, like, oh my gosh, we only have 5 summers left. But then also this idea of co-creation, right? I think that was the big aha moment. I talk about it in the parenting chapter, that so many of us come at it that we have to be prescriptive, right? Like, I, you know, want this for my child, so this is how we're going to go about this. And forgetting that they, you've created an individual, right? Yes, you should make an impact. And yes, family rules are important. And if you have, you know, a religious slant or an ideology that's important to you, these are not things that you need to circumvent. But to the point that you can let them in, because they are still ultimately developing as an individual. So you understand their preferences and tastes, and you build, you know, these amazing experiences with them, really becomes important. So that's what I do now. I talk to my kids and ask them what they want to do, and oftentimes let them lead, right? And so one of the things I've been doing a lot with my daughter is taking classes. And so she's really into cooking now. So it's, hey, Sloan, what do you want to cook? Because I mean, for me, it doesn't really matter. It's just that I do want to learn to cook. So I'm really enjoying the activity and I want to spend time with her. But doing that has really helped. And then I think, you know, if anyone that resonates with them, the added bonus that I kind of got from the science is that to the extent that you can find a teacher. So again, this doesn't come from a place of privilege. We were paying for lessons, but now we're just doing it on YouTube. And so because someone else is teaching us, if either one of us makes a mistake, there isn't that parental mentality, right, to try and correct her, or like, oh my, you know, like, don't do it that way. Like, if we make a mistake, then we celebrate it. Like, if there's a mess, we know we're going to clean it up, right? Where, like, again, if it was sort of this formulaic, like, I want to teach my kid how to make the perfect steak, there's still times for that, right? But I wouldn't classify that, you know, explicitly as fun because it's tied to an outcome. Instead, it's me and Sloan are taking a course together and we're going to really enjoy this. And, you know, the added benefit is we're learning something along the way.
It's fantastic. That's really beautiful. I'm sure, I was thinking about it after you write a book like this, I'm sure it had to reframe how you think about your day and how you spend your time.
Yeah. And I meant for sure. And the most has been, you know, thinking about time and its finality. You know, some of those aspects are dark, you know, because, you know, thinking that we are going to pass away one day doesn't necessarily put you in the best emotional state. But I think the idea of kind of back planning, what are the things, you know, when I do get to retirement that I really want to relish in? What am I going to be proud of? You know, using a tactic as simple as 2 days, 2 months, and 2 years, right? Like, if I'm really chewing on making a big decision, like, what is going to be the impact in 2 days, 2 months, and 2 years? And if it seems like a big deal 2 days from now, but in 2 years, I could care less, then I really don't give it a lot of energy, right? Because those bigger moments are going to be the things that are impactful as we grow older, not the little stuff that does seem like a big deal, but never is.
I actually like the last chapter of your book where you talk about death and you touch upon how it might sound morbid. I actually think knowing that life is finite, I find it makes me more motivated to plan and have fun and be present. So I like when you mention that paradoxical relationship between death and life satisfaction, because I actually think it's really true and not as morbid as it may sound from the outset.
Yeah, I think at the simplest, you know, viewpoint, the folks that do realize they're going to die eventually are the ones that find it the easiest to understand time affluence, right? Because, you know, it's interesting from a biological standpoint, and now we're kind of geeking out on science, but what we believe, right, is that most systems want to survive. I mean, especially if you buy into evolution, right, as creatures, all the way we're put together is to not think about death, because, and that includes our psyche, right, because we're supposed to live and procreate. And so it is something that's a learned skill to understand, like, well, eventually we aren't going to be here. And so under that guise, you do tend to make better decisions, right? Because you start to create options for yourself that resonate with what you want to get out of life instead of, you know, and a lot of folks are familiar with the work of Bronnie Ware, who was a palliative nurse that, you know, interviewed people, at, you know, that were close to the end of their death. And the folks that didn't do this work were the ones that ended up with the most regret. And so as a prophylactic to that, having the cue of knowing, the decisions that you make now really are going to have an impact. And we haven't even gotten to the neuroscience, right? I mean, there's emerging neuroscience that suggests that these core memories and even just indexing novel experiences creates this neural plasticity that we don't completely understand why yet, but those neural networks seem to be the glue that kind of staves off cognitive decline, right? We think that we can use that cognitive reserve, if we have these weird autoimmune, and you probably know better than me because I was relying on others' knowledge here, but, this idea that if we do kind of live life, in a mosaic way, we're building this tapestry of really, neat experiences and things that are different. We tend to have better physiological and psychological outcomes later in life. I mean, right now it's only a correlation. So I think, the causal arguments are developing, but it's clear that there is definitely a correlation to better outcomes across the board. For folks that, are looking for novelty, are having fun, are living, a life that's blended with joy and purpose.
It makes total sense to me. If you live every day the same, essentially going to work, going to school, those days and those weeks all blend together. But if you break it up with a new experience, you travel somewhere, you see something new, you spend a day at the beach with your kids, whatever it may be, that creates a new core memory. And it makes sense to me that it helps break up time, it elongates time. So I'm on board with that, that line of thinking. I think it's so true.
I forget if I put it in the book. I believe it came from Lisa Feldman Barrett, who's an amazing neuroscientist. And so she explained it simply to me because for anyone, hopefully it's equally beneficial, but this idea, if you had 100 copies of the same magazine, would you keep all 100 copies or would you keep one copy and just remember that you had 100? And the brain is the same way, right? We don't remember every single time we drove to work. We remember that we drove to work this one way 100 different times. And so it's just one neural network, right? And so, you could do something as simple as just driving to work a different way every day, and you'll start to encapsulate, more neural plasticity because your brain has to store those neural networks. And so I think that's as far as we've gotten of kind of understanding it. But, under that context, it totally makes sense, right? You start to have to develop these new memories that create, spaces in your brain. And so then you add on to that, like, okay, well, that sounds kind of silly. I don't want to just drive, differently to work every day. Well, cool. Now start sprinkling in things that really do fill you up. And so again, not only are you getting those neuro benefits, but, from a psychological standpoint, if you realize that your life is full of joy and it's always accessible there, even when you have, even a really crappy year, like you're going to remember that safety net because you have the ability to savor these things and know that they are there in abundance, even though life will have its slings and arrows from time to time.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation. I think your book really helps. I think as a parent, it really motivates me to maximize my time as much as possible with my kids, having new experiences, making sure I have fun in the future, fun in my day to day. I'll carve out that 2 to 5 hours. All of this advice, I think, has been really helpful and fun and a joy to learn from you. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Jessica. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. And I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of Ask Dr. Jessica. Also, if you could take a moment and leave a 5-star review wherever it is you listen to podcasts, I would greatly appreciate it. It really makes a difference to help this podcast grow. You can also follow me on Instagram at Ask Dr. Jessica. See you next Monday.